This message comes from Progressive Insurance and the Name Your Price tool. It helps you find car insurance options in your budget. Try it today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Not available in all states.
What's good? You're listening to Code Switch, the show about race and identity from NPR. I'm Gene Demby.
And I'm Christina Kahla.
Christina is Code Switch's senior producer. You've heard her work on the show before. But today, Christina is on the side of the mic again to talk to us about food. What are we doing?
We are going on an adventure, Gene. I am taking you, drum roll please, for your favorite place in the world. We're going to Taco Bell.
Let's go! I love Taco Bell, yo. I love Taco Bell. It's actually a problem.
We also have our producer, Jess Kung, here today. Woo-hoo. Say hi, Jess.
Hi.
And how do you feel about Taco Bell?
I'm 80% sure that Taco Bell is why I have this job.
Wait, say more, please.
Yes.
In my cover letter to be an intern, I told a story about how, this is a real story, in high school, I used to just like, I got out of school earlier than other people because of how my schedule was, and I had a car. So I would get Taco Bell and just drive around at like 2 p.m. Listening to podcasts and eating Taco Bell. Leah told me later that she had me down as the Taco Bell intern.
Leah Danella, our senior editor.
Taco Bell is perhaps why I have this job.
Cover letter is Taco Bell person.
Yeah.
So Code Switch has some Taco Bell lore to live up to today. So awesome.
Let's go.
All right. Do you know what you're going to order?
Crunchwrap Supreme.
Okay.
Chalupa. And one of the Tacos Locos, the Doritos with the Dorito crust, powder on it.
Brought you, what are you getting?
Is that us? Thank you so much.
So what do you think about Taco Bell's place in the world of Mexican food? Is Taco Bell Mexican food?
I don't think it is. I think Taco Bell, taxonomically, I was gonna make a taco joke, I was gonna say taconomically, but it's Taco Bell. It's like a different beast, different phylum or something. You know? It's like a platypus. It has sort of the shape of other things. But it is not those things. You know what I mean?
So Taco Bell has evolved to be similar to Mexican food?
I mean, it's, what is it?
I've been thinking about that a lot, which is why I wanted to do this episode about what is Mexican food. What does that mean? Where is the line for what is Mexican food? What is Mexican? What isn't? I actually talked to Gustavo Arellano all about Taco Bell, and he really believes that it is Mexican food.
My name is Gustavo Arellano. I am a columnist for the LA Times and the author of Taco USA, How Mexican Food Conquered America, and I'm based in Orange County, California.
So what are your thoughts on Taco Bell?
It's not good. It's not good. And of course it's Mexican food. It's bad fast food Mexican food. Like, there's this idea that when we talk about an ethnic food, it's supposed to be good. But that's not the case. We have to allow that some people, some versions of it are not going to be good. Some versions of it are ersatz, or however you pronounce that word. In other words, pale imitations of other things, but they're still Mexican food.
Good or not, if we're trying to figure out what Mexican food is and what role it plays in American cuisine, we have to talk about Taco Bell. It has the largest share of the U.S. Mexican food market, with over 7,700 locations, and accounts for almost 10% of all Mexican restaurants in the U.S. And while that empire may feel like it's been around forever, it was actually founded by Glenn Bell in 1962.
I have no issue with Taco Bell. My biggest issue was that Glenn Bell, in his autobiography, did not name the Mexican restaurant where he, quote unquote, got inspired to do tacos, which still exists. Meet La Cafe in San Bernardino, the perfect hard shell taco. If anyone's out there, you have to do your pilgrimage. But man and woman and others cannot subsist on Taco Bell alone. They're always going to know there is something better, and I want to taste that something better. So I credit Taco Bell as being that. Apostle is not the best word, because that would make them seem cool. I'm going to call them, maybe you could help me on this.
It's an entry point, maybe.
A mirage. That's what it is, a mirage. Yeah, and I'm going to use that from now on. This is why we talk. You see it out there. And then you go to it and you realize it's not the real thing. But now you have this vision of the real thing in you. And so you go out and seek it. And I think the person that does eat Taco Bell eventually realizes that, like maybe into their 15,000th Crunchwrap Supreme. And they're like, you know what? There has to be something better than this. But let me finish it and then we'll go.
Coming up, we finished our 15,000th Crunchwrap Supreme, and we're searching for something better. From the conquistador's love affair with chocolate to the classic San Francisco burrito, we're exploring the history of Mexican food in the United States.
Every taco that a white person eats is a victory for a Mexican, one way or another.
This message comes from Thuma. Create your oasis with Thuma, a modern design company that specializes in furniture and home goods. By stripping away everything but the essential, Thuma makes elevated beds with premium materials and intentional details. With clean lines, subtle curves, and minimalist style, the Thuma bed collection is available in 4 signature finishes to match any design aesthetic. To get $100 towards your first bed purchase, go to thuma.co/NPR. Support for this podcast and the following message come from Made in Cookware. President and co-founder Jake Kalick shares a tool that's useful for both master and newbie griller.
The craftsmanship of the carbon steel griddle enhances your grilling experience because it allows you a totally different type of grill surface that opens up the amount of food you're able to cook. So the griddle is the perfect accessory to add to your grill and kind of widen your grilling game.
Learn more about Made in Cookware at madeincookware.com. This message comes from BetterHelp. This Mental Health Awareness Month, BetterHelp is encouraging everyone to take care of their well-being and break the stigma associated with mental health. BetterHelp works to make people healthy and happy because when people are taken care of, everyone benefits, including families, colleagues, and communities. Visit betterhelp.com/NPR to get 10% off your first month.
Mexican food to me is delicious. Mexican food is historic. Mexican food is popular. Mexican food, above all, is an amalgamation of all the different traditions that have gone through Mexico over the millennia. And Mexican food is also hyper-regional. And really, at the end, Mexican food is whatever someone calls Mexican food. And I know that's not what you're supposed to say, but hey, I'm the guy who wrote the book on Mexican food, so therefore that's gospel. It's a commandment, better yet.
What do you think most Americans at this point think of as Mexican food?
Mexican food in the United States is like a 7-layer bean dip, in where every decade or so, you get this new, quote-unquote new, trend, fad, whatever you want to call it, that people think is, quote-unquote, authentic. No, this is the authentic Mexican food we've been waiting for. And the previous, quote-unquote, authentic Mexican dishes that had entranced Americans so much, they get pushed down.
At home, if I don't have, like, a pot of beans on or handy, I'm just, like, adrift in the world. You know, like, good tortillas and a pot of beans are home. That's, like, baseline participating in life as I know it.
That's Paloma Martinez Cruz. She's a professor of Latinx studies at The Ohio State University. And she's fascinated by what we eat and how that food gets to us.
If I'm not me without tortillas and frijoles, I'm not me if I'm not defending tortillas and frijoles. I'm not me if I'm not defending our right to have dignity and ecological balance in my tortillas and my frijoles.
Paloma is Chicana and New Yorican. In her book, Food Fight, Millennial Mestizaje Meets the Culinary Marketplace, she explores issues of appropriation, food pathways, and ethical consumption. And while her relationship with Mexican food is personal, it's also political and historical.
When we think about the U.S. diet, or what we're calling American food, so many of those things actually come from what's referred to as the Columbian Exchange. So what kinds of foods became available to Europeans after the voyages of Christopher Columbus, starting at the end of the 15th century? So we think of Europeans who came to the United States immediately needing to adopt turkey, corn, pumpkin, squash, beans, etc.
Chocolate, vanilla, amaranth, the chili pepper, nixtamalación, the very idea of getting corn, treating it with lye, and then making it edible. And now, you could eat corn raw as is, but if you eat too much of it, you're going to die, because corn kernels naturally have a toxin that's going to mess with you. If you eat too much of it, leads to the disease pellagra, which is not a good disease to have. But Mexicans were able to create the nixtamalación that leaches off the toxins, you know, opens up the kernel, like the molecules in that, to make it an even healthier meal. So, gosh, how much of America is run culinarily on corn, from feed for animals to ethanol to just corn itself, and then, of course, plastics and all of that. So right off the bat, like, Mexican food is foundational to what we are today as Americans.
Yeah, I loved, there's a quote in the book, he said, as part of Moctezuma's peaceful surrender, Cortes demanded that his court supply the conquistadors with native food, which they had grown to enjoy. The appropriation of Mexican food had begun.
Sad but true. I think from the start, it's important to acknowledge that Mexico, well, when it comes to Mexican food, people have been entranced by it, because it, again, there's just so much deliciousness to it. There's so much health to it. There's so much there that it also leads to people saying, I want a part of it. And for the most part, I agree that people should be allowed to eat other people's food and even make it their own. But when it comes with colonization, when it comes with exploitation and all those other things, then that's when it gets ugly. And obviously, in the case of the conquistadors, it became ugly fast. But on the other hand, even within the realm of appropriation, you have a total cliche, but it's an important cliche, resilience. So the Spaniards, they tried to convince the natives that their pulque was terrible, that it would poison them. And so they try to outlaw it. They try to convince the indigenous folks that if you want to be successful, you need to eat wheat, you need to eat bread. Corn is not going to allow you to have a truly Christian and European mind. And yet here we are. Yes, trigo, bread, tortillas de harina, they are a part of Mexico, but corn, como se dice, sin maíz, no hay país. We are the people of the corn, and so we persist.
And they persisted right through 1848 and the signing of the Treaty of Guadalupe, when, as the saying goes, the U.S. border crossed half of Mexico.
What used to be northern Mexico became the United States. And so you have culinary traditions that were in some ways not entirely interrupted, right? You had the consistency of Mexican food in what became geographic United States. When we think about barbecue, we have to think about Texas and how the fajita, for example, that translates as into like a belt or a sash. And that skirt steak was a cut that was often given to ranch hands as payment. You know, that's cowboy food. That's very much a north of the border type of thing to eat. You know, between Tex-Mex and let's just say Taco Bell, those became like blueprints of what we think of as Mexican food in the United States.
The example I always give, the first popular quote-unquote Mexican food item in the United States was chili, as Americans would call it, with an I, which Texans still know as chile con carne. Now you think of chili dogs, chili burgers, chili in a can, and all of that. But at one point in this nation's history, it was seen as authentic Mexican food.
Fun fact, one of the ways Mexican food made its way across the U.S. was in cans, which actually included tamales, sign me up, and tortillas. I'll stay far away from that. Though Gustavo told me you can still buy canned tortillas from prepper companies.
Because, hey, if the apocalypse is going to come, you still need tortillas, right?
You might also need a margarita.
The margarita came from Los Angeles, and it was invented to give, like, ladies who worked, you know, had some discretionary spending and wanted to take themselves out for a special occasion. It was a Mexican version of a daiquiri. The big massified burrito, that was a San Francisco Bay Area invention, taking the standard size burrito and making it palatable for the fire workers and construction workers, yeah, who came in and wanted larger portions. Uh-huh. But now we think of chipotle and how that's everywhere. Mm-hmm. But that definitely came from trying to appeal to non-heritage appetites and non-heritage consumer demands.
Mexican food as a category is hyper-regional in a way that most people can never comprehend because they're not traveling across the United States. So I have found even more traditions that have challenged my idea of what Mexican food is and have contributed greatly to my panza. It's true. Sad but true, but it's okay. It's been delicious.
It's worth it, right? Yeah. I love that. That also really makes me think about authenticity, I guess, a little bit. Like, that's an emotional part that I think is connected with food because it's such a carrier of culture. Like, it's such a carrier of identity. For me, there's also like this protectiveness that comes up. I don't know if you feel that way.
No, I don't.
Okay.
But no. But that's always, it's interesting, the idea of authenticity. So I always say either it's all authentic or none of it's authentic. And then my compa, Jose Rala, who's the taco editor for Texas Monthly, he says that the idea of authenticity is predicated on someone's grandmother. If your grandma made it, that makes it authentic. And then everyone else is a bunch of fakers. But I understand the idea of authenticity. You want something to be so pure, so magical, so uncorrupted by modernity, by Americans, by people who just don't appreciate it, that you can go back to it. And it's almost like a charging station. Like, whenever you're out there in the world and you need some sort of Mexican power, you need to re-up your vitality, you just go to this dish. And everyone has that dish. It could be, for me, it's always my mom's capirotada. May she rest in peace. It could be mole. It could be like the perfect lonchera there in Boyle Heights that makes just like the most perfect taco al pastor. We all have that ideal. And so I have less of an issue with authenticity than inauthenticity. Because when you start telling people that's not Mexican, that's not real, that's fake, that's when I have a problem, because you're questioning the person's existence. You're questioning their own heritage, their own roots. For instance, I recently came back from a road trip I made to Southern Colorado. I spoke in Colorado Springs and Pueblo, and their dishes are amazing because they have their own style of chile, the mirasol pepper. They make these so hard shell tacos, but they make them with flour tortillas, and they call them white. So like, if you want a chicken taco, you say, I want a chicken taco on white. And it is just the most delicious, fluffy, perfect crunchy taco you'll ever eat. But for most of the audience right now, they'll say, well, a hard shell fried taco, that's not Mexican. And Pueblo, Colorado, it's far away from Mexico, and blah, 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 blah. That's where I have a problem. I have a problem with the haterade. You want to call some food authentic, go for it, but don't call other people's food inauthentic, because you don't know. Have you been to Pueblo, Colorado? Probably not. So then you're in no position to say whether it's authentic or not.
I think authentic is kind of a garbage word. The words authentic and exotic are ways of like othering or fetishizing something, you know. Every establishment is going to be adapting to the ingredients that make sense and to the consumers, right? To the eaters that this place is preparing food for. So those adaptations are going to be part and parcel of what it means to serve food wherever you are. Like, what you eat does not make you a racist. And I don't think if you have a tater tot burrito, you know, you're going to racism jail. You should eat what you need to eat, and you need to eat what's available.
I'm happy to enjoy my tater tot burrito, but I still wonder about appropriation. Is it always bad? Do you think
it's not always bad? I think it's wonderful that white people, gabachos, especially in Southern California, that Mexican food is almost like their mother's milk. Like, if you're in Southern California, you are most likely going to eat Mexican food one way or another if you're brought up here. And I think that's an awesome thing. I think that allows for the Mexican food to expand its horizons. Korean tacos are amazing. Make arroz con pollo, but with tandoori chicken style. Like,
so good.
Oh my God. If you want to be totally purist, that's complete appropriation. Why should a Mexican kid be eating tandoori chicken? But that's how life is. Life is always about trying to make your world better. And if that involves food, that involves mixing food, then that's so much better for it. And I call me naive, But I always say that it didn't have to be this way with the conquistadors and all these other people, because historically, when you do conquer a people, one of the first things you malign and demonize even is what people eat. That's why in many cultures, one of the easy way to slur someone is by what they eat. Why do they call Mexicans beaners, you know? Or in the 50s, Taco Belly. They're saying, oh, your food's disgusting and we're not even going to eat it and we're going to use it against you. So if you get the oppressor to enjoy your food, already you won. Now, of course, it gets more complicated than that, but I think that alone is a crucial step in being able to resist complete annihilation or assimilation into the bigger culture. And it starts right there. Every taco that a white person eats is a victory for a Mexican, one way or another.
Coming up, that victory isn't always pretty.
You can go into a restaurant and find that while Mexican food is being celebrated, Mexican culture is being defamed.
We're talking about culinary brownface. Stay with us.
This message comes from LinkedIn Ads. Target your buyers by job title, company, role, and skills with LinkedIn Ads. All the professionals you need to reach in one place. Get a $100 credit on your next campaign at linkedin.com/results. Terms and conditions apply. This message comes from Bombas. Nearly 30% of marathoners end their race blistered. Bombas running socks are strategically cushioned to help say bye to blisters. Run to bombas.com/NPR and use code NPR for 20% off your first purchase. This message comes from NPR sponsor Vuori, featuring the performance jogger from Vuori's DreamKnit collection, fabricated with their softest premium stretch fabric. Inspired by an active lifestyle, the performance jogger is incredibly lightweight and stylish. Invest in your happiness with some of the most comfortable and versatile clothing on the planet. Receive 20% off your first purchase at Vuori.com/NPR on any U.S. orders over $75 and free returns. Exclusions apply. Visit the website for full terms and conditions.
These days, there's a lot of news. It can be hard to keep up with what it means for you, your family, and your community. Consider This from NPR is a podcast that helps you make sense of the news. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a story and provide the context, backstory, and analysis you need to understand our rapidly changing world. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
All right, Gene. Here we go.
Gene.
Christina.
Code Switch. Christina is our senior producer here at Code Switch, and she's been taking us through this history, this culinary history of Mexican food in the United States, and looking into this question of when a food becomes, and I'm doing air quotes here, American.
I've been talking to Gustavo Arellano, the author of Taco USA, How Mexican Food Conquered America.
You have to remember what we're talking about, Mexican food, and who ostensibly makes it? Mexicans. And what are Mexicans in the American mind? A threat to the very idea of the United States.
I talked to Gustavo about how stereotyping Mexicans in the U.S. bleeds into the way people view Mexican food.
This is a centuries-long struggle, fight, war, clash of civilizations, if you will, that really goes back to the idea of the Black legend that the English created about the Spaniards, that anything that the Spaniards and their descendants touched was doomed, was filthy, was perverted, and all of that. Yet the American mind cannot avert their eyes to the allure of everything that Mexicans offer them. So when it came to Mexican food, it was seagull meat, it was dog meat. They call loncheras, taco trucks, roach coaches. Mm-hmm. You have to watch out for Montezuma's revenge. You can't eat beans because it's going to make you fart. This, and that. But that never stopped the American from consuming the meal. Because, you know, it's easy to trash gabachos. It's like the easiest thing to do. But you got to give them credit when credit's due, because it has been the American, the white American above all, historically, things have changed now. We're a more diverse country, thank God, that has been wanting to eat Mexican food, that has made Mexican food such a success, and that paved the way for other cultures and Mexicans more than anyone to be able to be successful off of Mexican food, and to not just successful, but allow them to realize, like, hey, I can bring in my regional food, and it's first going to feed my compadres y comadres, mis paisanos y paisanas. But then other people are going to realize how amazing it is, and so it'll be able to stand on its own.
Yeah, so this brings me to the question that I'm trying to ask in this episode, which is really, like, when and how a food becomes, you know, quote unquote, American.
Yeah.
And if that's even like a yardstick we want to be measuring by. So Mexican food is the third most popular food in this country.
Yeah.
Yeah. And about 1 in 10 new restaurants in the U.S. is Mexican.
Yeah.
So there's this huge love of Mexican food, but where does that leave us? Like, is it America's cuisine? Is that even the question that we should be asking?
Yeah, look, Mexican food is as American as tacos. Straight up. Mexican food is also interesting in that it, along with Chinese food and Italian food, I would argue, are American foods that are nevertheless always seen as foreign. Yeah, pizza at this point, no one thinks it's foreign food. But look, it's Italian food. Orange chicken, same thing. And of course, it's Americanized. But with Chinese and Mexican food, because those countries are so huge and you still have those that patterns of migration, new quote unquote new styles of those foods are coming into the United States and replenishing itself. But still, like, you could go to small town America and you still have the classic Chinese American buffet. So I totally think Mexican food is American food. Again, because, you know, people who are not of Mexican heritage growing up with it, making businesses out of it, being part of that landscape, but still, because of that complicated history between the two countries, it's never going to be seen as a fully American food.
Yeah.
But because the Mexican cannot be American. Even as the American consumes the Mexican's food, the American can never fully accept Mexican, Donald Trump voters notwithstanding.
Paloma Martinez Cruz wrote an essay about the U.S.'s love affair with Mexican food, and how at the same time that the country loves the food, it's actively hostile to the people. I quoted back to her something that she wrote that really stuck with me.
If only bordered bodies could circulate as freely and exaltedly as burritos. If only our children were as beloved as our chalupas, end quote.
Yeah.
Why do you think it's so easy for people in the U.S. to remove the food from the people?
That is colonization 101. Colonial logic is all about extracting a resource from its original context and misappropriating it in many cases. So we see that with Mexican food in the United States, where restaurants use what I refer to as culinary brownface. So you can go into a restaurant and find that while Mexican food is being celebrated, right? That's what you're going to buy there. At the same time, Mexican culture is being defamed. An example is, like, there's a restaurant drink special called Cinco de Drinco. They're using mock Spanish as a real sign of a culinary brownface establishment. We see that phenomenon in non-heritage restaurants that are using these bandido, these peon stereotypes. It's confirming white superiority while extracting what's desirable about Mexican culture. And it's keeping Mexicans in their place.
Yeah. When you said colonialism as the answer, I was like, duh, that makes so much sense. And yet in my head, I'm like, but how do you even get there?
Yeah.
And maybe that's, like, really naive of me, but why didn't I get to that answer on my own?
Yeah. Those blind spots are really manufactured, right? Like, this blind spot that we have to racism in Mexican foodways. If we're going, yeah, ching chong talk is wrong and blackface minstrelsy is wrong, we shouldn't do those things. But we walk into the Mexican restaurant that has all of these stereotypes and all of this linguistic violence taking place. And we're like, yep, that's cool, right? Like, these blind spots are calculated.
Yeah.
And it's something really specific about the North-South relationship between United States and Mexico, right? There is the rampant U.S. rejection of Mexican people that is so normalized. It is so banal that the everyday violence of Mexican restaurants, that this gets a pass. And these contact zones in Mexican restaurants, they help to normalize the hatred of Mexican people and cultures. But I think that just having a little bit more information can make us a little more aware that when we spend our money, every time we do that, we're voting for the world we want to see.
I want to celebrate the person who is enthusiastic about food, enthusiastic about Mexican food, sees it as a representation of pride, of heritage, and deliciousness, and is able to make a living for themselves, for their family, and also bonus points if what they feed us is actually delicious.
Like the chef, Cristina Martinez.
Bueno, mi nombre es Chef Cristina Martinez. Soy Mexicana.
Cristina has two restaurants in Philly, South Philly Barbacoa and Casa Mexico. And she's been working in the restaurant industry for about 15 years. She talked to me during the lunch rush at Casa Mexico.
Estamos haciendo moles, carnitas, cochinita pibil, pozole, pancita de res, algo de México, pero más enfocado en la comunidad de Capuluac.
Most of the food is from Capuluac, where she's from, and where she first learned how to cook with her parents when she was 6 years old.
Desde los 6 años empecé a cocinar con mis padres de manera tradicional, con el hoyo y haciendo barbacoa.
She started learning the traditional way. She was cooking barbacoa over the weekends, and her parents would take her to buy vegetables on Mondays and Tuesdays. They'd prep the different parts throughout the week, little by little. Nopales, rajas. It's a long process.
Se van preparando poco a poco, pelando los nopales, cortando las rajas. Entonces, hay un proceso muy largo antes de hacer un servicio de barbacoa.
These are pre-Hispanic methods, which require patience. For Cristina, who is making the food matters. Mexican hands are part of what make a food Mexican.
En las manos tienes el sazón.
As Cristina puts it, a Mexican person has sazón, or flavor, in their hands.
Cada quien tiene ese sabor en sus manos, como la memoria. Mi mamá hizo unas tortillas y me las mandó, pero es maíz criollo que están poniendo en la mesa en Filadelfia para una familia. Pero eso es súper importante porque la alimentación sigue haciendo que la gente dure más años.
And that's what people yearn for when they yearn for home. A tortilla their mother made with traditional ingredients. It's important to bring that to the table.
I would say Mexican food at its best, you can't just find just anywhere. Like, you have to go and find it and appreciate the regionality of all of that. And yeah, I extend that to the United States as well.
Everybody's authenticity is based on their memory and their experience of a food and a place. It might be what your grandma made. It might also be the thing you grew up eating. For Paloma Martinez Cruz, it's the pot of beans that's always sitting on the stove. For Gustavo Arellano, it's his mom's capirotado. But someone else's grandma might have made something different, like a tater tot burrito. And who's to call you out on what dish restores your life force, your energy? Mexican food, just like Mexican people, has been in the U.S. for longer than it's been a country. So go out and find some. Maybe just not Taco Bell.
And that's our show, even if it ended on Taco Bell slander. You can follow us on Code Switch at NPR Code Switch, all one word. If email's more your thing, ours is codeswitch@npr.org, and listen in the NPR app or wherever it is you get your podcasts. You can also subscribe to the Code Switch newsletter by going to npr.org/codeswitchnewsletter.
And just a reminder that signing up for Code Switch Plus is a great way to support our show and public media. And you'll get to listen to every episode sponsored free. So please go find out more at plus.npr.org/codeswitch. This episode was produced by me, Christina Kalla, with help from Jess Kung. It was edited by Courtney Stein. Our engineer was James Willits.
And we'd be remiss if we did not shout out the rest of the Code Switch Massive. That's Xavier Lopez, Leah Donella, Dahlia Mortada, Vera Lynn Williams, and B.A. Parker. As for me, I'm Gene Demby.
And I'm Christina Kahla.
Be easy, y'all.
Hasta pronto.
This message comes from Warby Parker, prescription eyewear that's expertly crafted and unexpectedly affordable. Glasses designed in-house from premium materials starting at just $95, including prescription lenses. Stop by a Warby Parker store near you.
This message comes from Jackson. Seek clarity in retirement planning at Jackson.com. Jackson is short for Jackson Financial Inc., Jackson National Life Insurance Company, Lansing, Michigan, and Jackson National Life Insurance Company of New York, Purchase, New York.
This message comes from LinkedIn Ads. One of the hardest parts about B2B marketing is reaching the right audience. That's why you need LinkedIn Ads. You can target your buyers by job title, company, role, seniority, and skills. All the professionals you need to reach in one place. To get a $100 credit on your next campaign so you can try it yourself, just go to linkedin.com/results. That's linkedin.com/results. Terms and conditions apply. Only on LinkedIn Ads.